In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about SaaS revenue patterns, increasing annual renewals, and answer more listener questions. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 376. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at building, launching, and growing software products. Whether you've built your first product, or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we made. What is the word this week, sir?
Well, there's no word this week, but next week I will be headed to Big Snow TinyConf East and, you know, spending a couple of days up there. There's about a dozen people or so that go up each year and just kind of hang out and hit the slopes every day and then talk business in the evenings. So that'll be a good time. I've been really looking forward to it. It's been a while since I've been skiing.
Yeah. And you go there every year and you just come away with a lot of, I don't know, you come away with a lot of motivation and a lot of good ideas, and it seems to really, really work for you. So I'm glad that you're able to go back again this year.
Yeah, I definitely need the time away from my computer, to be honest, at this point. I've been heads down for, I don't know, the past several months straight, and, you know, haven't really had any time to come up to breathe. So,
yep. Now, it's always good to get away, whether it's to go on a retreat or to do something like this. I think it's a good call, man. I actually wish I could go this year. I won't be able to. Obviously, it's like sold out and stuff, but I don't ski, so I would show up to drink hot cocoa and I don't know what I'd do, watch movies or something, just walk or just snowshoe or something. But I do think it'd be a lot of fun to go to one of them. And there, at one point, there were three each year, right? But I think, I don't know if there's a Europe one this year. I think it might be just East and West.
Yeah, it's just East and West this year. I think the Europe one, they couldn't get enough people committed to going. There was interest, but just nobody kind of stepped up and said, hey, we're definitely in.
Yeah, that makes sense. Cool. Well, hey, we got a note from a listener. His name is Francois Lagier, and he says, I just wanted to reach out and say thank you. Rob and Mike, I'm a co-founder of a new SaaS company called cloudforecast.io. I wanted to reach out and say thank you for a few things. He has a bulleted list of thanks, which is kind of cool to get this detailed stuff. First, thank you for all the good content in Startups for the Rest of Us. I recently started listening to your podcast, and I've been searching the archive for any episodes mentioning the word SaaS. So as a new entrepreneur, I'm learning so much. Second, you mentioned Perfect Audience many times for your retargeting strategy. Both my co-founders and I were part of the early team at Perfect Audience. Interesting. And we are very proud of our work there. So thank you for putting a smile on my face every time you mention it. Yeah, I've been a fan of Perfect Audience for a long time. And Brad, one of the founders, I've spoken with him on the phone several times. And in fact, he was one of the founders that I called during the Drip acquisition, because he's gone through an acquisition. And I just wanted to get his sense of do's and don'ts and how it went there. So I always appreciate, you know, being able to talk to him. And now back to Francois's email. Third, I listened to episode 319 a few days ago, and Rob literally mentioned the problem we are trying to solve. And then he quotes me, and I say, I had a counter reminder every 2 weeks. It would ping us and it would say, check AWS billing. So thank you for confirming that our idea is not completely crazy, since cloudforecast.io is a daily email report that breaks down your forecasted AWS spending by products, tags, and regions, allowing you to understand where your money is going. So once again, thank you for everything. Have a great week.
That's awesome. Thanks, Francois. I really appreciate the email. And it's very interesting looking at the report that he had sent over as well, just seeing the forecast of the cloud computing spend. It's interesting seeing it broken down like this. I don't have nearly the expenses that are shown here, so I don't have to worry about it as much, but I can definitely see how larger installations using cloud services would definitely find it appealing.
Yeah, so thanks for the email, Francois. I really appreciate it. What else is going on with you? What's the update on Bluetick?
Well, I'm working on a couple of minor bugs, but right now I'm trying to close out the final testing process for deploying the latest release that I've been working on. So I'm hoping that that'll go out by the end of today. And it's basically a series of major improvements to testability and test coverage, and then overall resilience of the app to different error conditions and performance, scalability, et cetera. And the big thing is that it makes it easier and safer for me to make a bunch of updates moving forward, just because the increased test coverage makes it, you know, obviously like less prone to errors, but when things go wrong, I'll be able to see them before it hits the production server. Because there were certain sections of the app that were critical to the entire thing running and being able to send out the emails and recognize when replies came in. And I won't say that they were completely hacked together, but there was a lot of code in there that handled specific edge cases that needed to be separated out a little bit, I'll say. So just the refactoring will make it easier to make changes in a way that does not terrify me to do so.
Yeah. Oh, that's such a, it's such a luxury. I mean, a really nice, well, I say it's a luxury. It's now a must have, you know, if I were to, I think I've said this before, like never again will I run an app that does not have full test coverage. So that's cool. Did that take you a few weeks?
Yeah, it's taken me probably 4 or 5 weeks at this point. So there were a couple of places where I thought it was done a few weeks ago and then ran into a couple of issues. Like I had one entire section of the app completely taken care of, and then I didn't realize it, but there was implications of the changes that I made over in the job scheduler. So I had to basically refactor a lot of that code as well. And then, of course, once you do that, then you got to go through all the tests. But in doing so, I've realized that it made things a lot easier to write like a suite of tests. So I was able to do that. And I've got, you know, I basically doubled the number of unit tests that are in the app based on this set of changes.
That's cool. Time well spent, I think. It's one of those trade-offs of, you know, you're trying to move fast so you don't write the tests, and then it will eventually come back to bite you. And it tends to come back in delayed features later on, right? Or I guess decreased velocity, feature velocity, because you start breaking things or a lot of bugs, right? Quality. I mean, that's kind of been my experience with tests, is that they add that 20, 25% up front, but we have just, you know, with Drip have been able to continue moving at a pace that a lot of apps that are 5 years old are not. And it's because of that. Derek and I have commented many times that having a software company with no technical founders is a tough way to go. And I see this, I bring this up because I've seen several companies do it. And unless you find, you know, you find that co-founder, or I'm sorry, not the co-founder, but unless you find a contractor or the salaried employee number one, who is just really hell-bent on writing the tests, it's easy to just push that aside. And I think it's to the detriment of a lot of software companies that are trying to do it.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough position to be in. But, you know, I can't stress like the unit test side of things. It's always a trade-off because you want to move faster. But if you don't take the time to write those tests and have them in place, then later on you get to a point where things are breaking left and right and you have no choice but to kind of stop and go back and in some way, shape, or form put them in place, because otherwise you really can't make any progress forward. So there's always that balancing act between how quickly you're moving versus, you know, how many tests you're implementing.
For sure. Well, let's dive into our listener questions today. The first one is about SaaS revenue patterns. It's from Basil Abbas from clockit.io. And he says, "Hey, Mac and Rob, huge fan of your show, and I've been religiously following it for 2 years. You guys provide a ton of value in each episode and helped us launch our SaaS app to $2,500 in MRR in the first year. In year one of the operation, I've noticed there are some patterns to how the MRR grows month to month. For example, in the months of January, February, and March, we were growing at roughly 30 to 40%, and then we fell to 15 to 20%. For the rest of the year. November was a fantastic month with 40% growth until Thanksgiving, and now we have 0% growth in December. We also noticed that 1 week before and after major holidays in the US, our growth flatlines, but it picks up after. In your experience, have you come across such patterns?"
I think in B2B SaaS, yes. I've definitely seen this with Blue Tick lately, where in December, things, I would say, more or less flatlined. And that was probably due to a combination of things, mostly me stepping away from the marketing. But I've heard from various other founders that the same kind of thing tends to happen to them as well. And Rob, I think you've commented on this in the past, where you just kind of take December off because it's not really worth doing anything except preparation for January and February. I have seen things dip in the summer months as well, and then they kind of pick up after the summer. In terms of like B2C stuff, I don't know. I would imagine in December, you can probably count on some sort of a revenue bump because you're going into like the holiday season and you can get people to buy stuff for either as gifts or gifts for themselves, to be honest. Definitely done that with my book as well. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I've seen. Rob, what about you?
Yeah, I definitely have seen patterns. The patterns he mentioned is odd. He says like the first 3 months of the year, they grew a ton and then half that rate for the rest of the year. Obviously it's going to depend on the app. I remember when I had Apprentice Lyman Jobs, which is a job board, tons of traffic on Sunday evening because everyone was dreading going to work the next day. Or they didn't have a job and they, you know, had kind of pissed away the weekend and they were like scrambling, thinking like, oh, I really need to gear up and do it. So it was this fascinating pattern of that. Straight ahead SaaS, when I think about like Hittail and Drip, I remember that it was either April and May were always sketchy, and I attributed it to being tax time here in the US. December was always a train wreck, flat at best. Sometimes we would, you know, you'd lose customers. Other than that, though, all the rest of the months were pretty similar. And I don't remember there being any kind of summer slowdown. So I don't know. There are definitely some patterns, but I think that you want to look, you know, once you have 2 or 3 years, you can really see more of a recurring pattern to find out. Because some months would just be slower, but it wasn't, you know, year to year that it was the same. It's just randomness, right? It's just these things that, you know, can be somewhat random. So Basil had a second question, and I'm gonna rephrase it slightly because I think if I read exactly what he says, folks will be a little confused. But he says, could you also touch on if it's okay to consider a 5% weekly MRR growth rate? Should I think about it as a percentage, or should I think about it more as like a dollar amount? I think is really what he's getting at. Because you think about it, you know, let's say you're doing $5,000 MRR and a 5% weekly growth rate would put you at $250 each week. And so do you think of, boy, we want to grow by a percentage each week, or we're going to continue to grow by a percentage each week, or are we going to grow by 250 each week so that when you hit 10K, you're actually now growing at 2.5% a week, right? And the way I think about this, and there's a few ways to think about it. I think that what you have in place today will continue to add the dollar amounts, right? Let's say you have a bunch of existing traffic from SEO and you're doing outbound or you're doing paid ads or whatever. That is going to continue to give you a dollar amount in general and not a percentage. So as your revenue goes up, you're not going to necessarily see that you're going to keep up with the percentage growth. That's where if you want to keep growing at 5% week over week, you have to either increase those traffic channels or you have to add new ones to keep it at 5%. Because, you know, if you think about it, if you go to 20 or 30 grand, growing at 5% week over week is really, really hard. Whereas if you're at 2 grand, growing 5% is not that much, right? You're just adding a small trickle of revenue.
Yeah, I was going to point out the big difference between, you know, it depends on what your total amount is right now, because going from 5 customers to 10 is a lot easier than going from 1,000 customers to 10,000. And it's just like the amount of time that it takes is going to make a big difference between, you know, based on how many customers you currently have. So
for sure. So I do like to think about it in percentages because it's more aggressive. But realize if you do just have kind of, you know, linear traffic coming in, linear conversion rate, like all the same, it's that dollar amount is what's going to stay. And so you know, if you look at there's another factor that comes into this, and that's the bigger you get, the more churn hurts, right? Because you'll plateau eventually. When you have 1,000 or 10,000 customers, a 5% churn rate is a hell of a lot of people that you have to replace. When you only have 20 customers, 5% churn rate is, you know, one person. So you got to think about all this. As you scale, you do come into new problems to continue to grow. All right, our next question is about annual renewals and how to encourage more of them. And it's from Gareth Halsall from driverguardian.co.uk. He says, hope you're doing well. I get a ton of value from the podcast, so thanks for the output. Our business is not SaaS, but I would love your input. We have an annual product that our members pay for once a year. At the minute, we send 3 renewal email reminders, 1 month before, 1 week before, and 3 days before. We also send a letter that is designed to arrive after the last email. We're considering sending text messages that go out before the letter, as it would save on postage cost if we could get a response. I would appreciate any input or discussion on what both of you think the ideal roadmap for renewal should be for a single-time annual recurring payments product. What do you think?
So if anyone who's not at a computer or is not familiar with driverguardian.co.uk, it essentially looks a lot like AAA here in the US, where you get this membership and provide you various discounts for just showing your AAA card. But at the same time, it also gives you coverage if you run out of gas or if your car breaks down or you blow a tire or something along those lines. Like you can call AAA and they'll come and they will help you out. And so they'll send a tow truck. And it's kind of like having insurance to the point that if your car breaks down, they'll come help you out and you don't have to pay the emergency towing rates at the time, whenever that happens. I have my own AAA membership, and what they do is they just automatically bill me at that point. So they have my credit card on file and they don't even really ask for a renewal. It's just you're on this automatic renewal. That works, obviously, if your credit card is not expired, but even if it is, depending on what company you have that is doing your credit card processing, it may still work after the fact. So if, for example, Stripe, I know that in certain situations, if a credit card expires, expires, it will still bill properly, even though the credit card itself has expired. So that's something you might want to take a look at. The other thing is AAA does send a letter in the mail that basically says, hey, here's all the information. But again, like they already bill me for it and I don't actually have to pay that invoice. It just automatically gets paid anyway. So I feel like it's just a kind of a reminder that, hey, you know, we're about to bill you for this. So I don't know. I mean, I think that sending out those renewal email reminders is helpful, but, you know, definitely taking a look at sending them physical letters is probably a good strategy to go after, just because you're putting something physically in front of them. And if it's not going to the right place, it may very well get returned or it will get forwarded over, versus email delivery can be hit and miss, I'll say, especially depending on how many emails you're sending them on a regular basis anyway. And that's kind of the big question I would raise at this point, is how many emails are you sending them throughout the course of the year to begin with? And do you know that you're getting into their mailboxes?
Yeah, I think the approach I would take, or I know the approach I would take, is what you said with AAA. Because I love, as a customer, the fact that I set it up once and they notify me. They're like, hey, we're going to rebill you in a month. And I don't have to go log in or click any buttons or anything. It's just done and it's always there. And so that, I mean, I would move the whole business model to automatically renew every year. And you're very upfront about this, right? When they sign up, hey, this will renew automatically. Maybe it's a checkbox that's checked by default. You know, hey, do you want us to bill you each year? And some people will uncheck it. And then you have a different thing if that makes you feel more comfortable. Personally, I would just say this auto renews every year. I mean, that's the point. And you can easily cancel it with one click. And we're going to notify you multiple times before we do it. And then do the approach that you've mentioned, which is these three emails. But instead of saying, hey, renew, it should say, hey, well, we're going to bill you and it's this much. And just click right here if you want to make any changes to this. You know, if you want to opt out and we won't bill you. I do love the idea of SMS as well. I think that if postage costs are kind of a killer, then you could send the SMS and avoid sending the letter altogether. So I think moving towards an opt-out model is the way that I would go with this, and then still notify the people to make sure that, you know, that they do receive the stuff.
I did notice on their site they have one of the selling points is that it says no auto renewal, and it actually puts you in a tough spot because of this side of it. And I don't know whether that's because specifically, like, you know, laws over in the UK or in Europe that say that you can't do that, or if it's just something that you guys came up with that you wanted to pitch to people because that you were tired of being auto-billed for stuff that you didn't really want or need. But it really, it's like, I view it almost like the donor cards here in the US, where they're statistically proven that if you have a opt-out model versus an opt-in model, your opt-out rate is going to be substantially lower than if you reverse it. People will basically just choose the path of least resistance, and they're not going to bother to go through that extra work in order to opt out. But the reverse is true as well.
I would bet that if they pulled the, you know, does not auto renew off the marketing site, there would be almost zero impact to their conversion rate. Unless this is some big competitive advantage, and I don't feel like it is, I think that shouldn't impact most things, especially if you give, you know, if you really want to do it, then give people the option. Obviously, going backwards, you know, if you have 5,000 existing customers, you're going to grandfather them into what you do now. But I would consider, to be honest, adding it as a feature and then emailing everybody and saying, hey, we've set up this thing for your convenience by popular request. I'm sure someone has requested this at some point, because I use services when they don't auto-renew me and I say, why don't you build this? I actually don't want to have to go in and re-enter my credit card every 6 months or every 12 months. So certainly someone has requested this at some point. So bill it and see how many existing customers you can get, you know, on auto-renew and go from there. I bet it'll have an impact on your bottom line for sure. All right, our next question is from Ovi Negrian, and his company is socialbee.io. That's B-E-E.io. He says, hey guys, in a recent episode, you talked about how there are not as many productized services that have been turned into SaaS as you thought. As another data point, socialbee.io has also started with a large service component, and I wrote why it's good to start with a service first in Medium, and we'll include that link. He says, I think it's indeed an underutilized technique that can turn more wannapreneurs into entrepreneurs. So there we go, Mike, another data point. I think I was the one who made that comment, and I still think it's a lot fewer productized services to SaaS have been done as I think perhaps should be done, I guess. I still see so many people shooting for the fences. I also think far few people use the stair-step approach too. You know, these are both lower risk, more repeatable, higher chance of success. You know, these are approaches that do that for you. And I still think that it's not as popular as it probably should be.
Yeah, this was one of my 2017 predictions. So we covered this in the predictions episode back in episode 370. So yeah, and that's the comment I had made was that I didn't have very many data points. Like I felt like the bar for launching a SaaS was going to be continue to become harder to reach, but startups who were going to go the route of offering a services first-based approach, followed by implementing SaaS, was going to become more prevalent. And I didn't see a lot of data points as really the problem. So Uwe, really appreciate you sending that in.
My next email is from Kelvin. It's about choosing your tech stack. He says, "Hey guys, I'm not a software developer. I'm more of a marketer. But my question is this. As a non-technical founder, how do you choose what type of code to build your app on?" So he's asking about the tech stack. "I'm trying to build a rank tracker." What do you think, Mike?
It's so heavily dependent on what it is that you're trying to do. So it's hard to just give a general answer for that. I mean, you really need to have somebody who has that technical background to be able to make the decisions, because they're depending on what you're building, certain types of technical decisions can back you into a corner that's really hard to get out of, or the entire thing could end up falling down at some point because it just can't scale or do the types of things that you needed to do. And a rank tracker is probably one of those things where you need to choose the right technology, because if you don't, it's not going to scale the way that you need it to, and you're not going to be able to create things in a distributed manner or spread out the jobs and the spidering that needs to go with it in order to be able to do what you need to do. The other thing to consider, especially in this particular case, is that if you are scraping websites in order to do any sort of a rank tracker, you have to be a little bit careful because you can get banned from them. And I know of at least two people who have had to deal with issues where their scraping techniques were noticed and their app was essentially banned from those websites. So they looked at it as, oh, you're basically DDoSing our site. It's like, well, no, I'm spidering it, but they don't see it that way. So if your entire business rests on doing that, then it's a significant risk if that vendor or that company decides to take action to prevent you from doing it. I ran into this probably 12 to 15 years ago with McAfee, where I was scraping their website using a Perl script, and then they kept changing things around on their website, so it made it difficult to find like what the antivirus definition numbers were, because that's what I was trying to pull. And they kept changing things around, and eventually I wrote a script that would pull it down, and it would parse it in like five different ways and try and get to what the ID was, because they just kept changing the HTML, and I noticed that they were alternating it between them. So I just figured I'd do that. But yeah, I mean, this is a hard question to answer just because it depends so heavily on what it is that you're building.
I like the points you brought up. I think that building a rank tracker has some dangers to it. Don't think you shouldn't do it because of that, but know that there are substantial risks, because a rank tracker, this is not for search engines, he mentioned specifically. So it's a rank tracker for another ecosystem. And it's going to almost always be against the terms of service. And so if you do it, you're going to have to do it on the down low, like Mike said. And you're probably, I mean, it's going to be part of your process that A, rank trackers are brittle, because anytime the UI changes, it's going to break everything. And so you're going to have a fire drill. So know that going in. So you're going to want a developer who, you know, doesn't have a 1 to 2 week delay to get back to you. I mean, you're going to want someone who's able to hop on things. Second thing is you will likely need to get a bunch of cheap servers with different IPs, because at any given time, some of them are going to get blacklisted. Just like you said, Mike, you can't do this at scale without that. The people I know who've built these had these massive server farms, and at any given time, they're all running the same code. And at any given time, like, you know, 20% of them were banned and blacklisted, and they would cycle them through. So that it will be an operational thing that you will perpetually have. And again, I'm not saying don't do this, but think about that up front. His question is, how do you decide, you know, on what language to use? And the way you do that is you learn about the languages and which are good at different things, right? So like Python and Perl are really good at scraping. I would probably use Python in this case. That isn't, his question was what, you know, it wasn't what technology should he use, but that's probably what I would do. I would look for a Python Django developer and build your scraper and build your, you know, web front end all in Python. But a broader question is, if you're not building a rank tracker and you're building a different type of SaaS, what languages should someone consider? These days, I would say Ruby on Rails, Python Django. Those are probably one of the two. They're going to be, those are common. You're going to be able to find developers. If you ever wanted to sell, they're not languages that people shun. Like when I had Hittail and Classic ASP, someone was asking if they could buy it. And as soon as I told them it was in classic ASP, they said they had no interest in it, so that they would have to rewrite the whole thing. So we eventually rewrote it in Ruby on Rails, and that was much more sellable. .NET and Java also are can be looked at that in the startup space. They're not as appealing because the .NET and Java developers tend to be, you know, they're more enterprisey, and it's not as easy to find, let's say, startup developers who are gonna be into that. It's gonna be easier with these other ecosystems. Now, there are other languages that are up and coming, and I think if you really wanted to get ahead of the curve, you know, there's Elm and Elixir and Phoenix. Elixir and Phoenix go together. I think those are going to perhaps, you know, pull some market share in terms of like startups being built. I think those are going to slowly pull market share from Ruby and or Python. And this comes from conversations with Derek, and then, you know, he's my co-founder at Drip, and then other developers that I'm hearing talking about these things. People are really excited about them, and they're looking for jobs in them, and they're not that widely available. So if I was a non-technical founder, I don't think I would branch into that because it is too new still, and I'd probably go with something more tried and true.
Yeah, I mean, the big question there is, like, are the problems that you are likely to run into things that have been solved before? And with bleeding edge products or technologies or tech stacks, sometimes you're just blazing new ground yourself, and there's no solutions or resources out there. And you basically have to do a lot of research and development to solve particular types of problems, versus with established products like Ruby on Rails, it makes it easier for you to find, you know, a common solution to a common problem.
And one other stack you could consider is PHP. There are obviously a lot of apps built in that, and ones that scale as well. I'm pretty sure Facebook is built in PHP. Obviously, WordPress, which scales pretty well. But it is, in my experience, and I of those three languages I'm recommending, actually, the PHP is the only one I know, and it can be a complete cluster. So I think I would stick more towards the Python Ruby part of things. PHP, well written and well structured, is a perfectly acceptable web language, but there's so much of it that is not. It's easy to hang yourself. All right, let's look at our next email. It's about corporate structures and trademarks from Dylan DiMartino. And he says, hey guys, two quick questions I'd like your opinion on. Number one, I have a consulting company incorporated in the state of Louisiana, but I want to start a SaaS with its own name. Would you suggest simply creating it under the umbrella of my current corp, or should I start a separate entity? I noticed a lot of the big apps share the same name as their parent company, Uber and Snapchat. Is this standard practice? Is it worth it? Does it make marketing easier? So I think there's two aspects to that. One is, does it matter that the product name and the corporation name match from a marketing perspective? And then the second thing, I think, of course, is liability, right? Do you lump it in with consulting? Do either one of those, because then those assets are unprotected. What do you think, Mike?
This is an interesting question to me, mainly because I'm going through it right now, where I am spinning off Bluetick into its own separate corporate entity. So having just recently talked to both my CPA and my attorney, I'm spinning it off into its own separate LLC. And the question I'm kind of going through right now is, does it really matter whether or not the app itself is the same name as the company? And I've decided that no, it really doesn't matter, because the app is kind of the front end facing. So I will be likely going with a company name that is different than the product. Now, I do that because I don't think that it makes any difference at all to the end user. But a couple of things you do have to keep in mind is that when you're putting things into like your terms and conditions and privacy policy and stuff like that, the company name is what's going to have to be listed there along with the product name. The reason I decided against going with the product name as the company name is, one, there's already a company out there called, I think, Bluetick Incorporated or something like that, as Bluetick Outfitters, something along those lines. But Bluetick.com and BluetickInc.com are both taken. So I didn't want to run in any sort of trademark infringement problems with that. And because it's a software app, and I think that was a in the petroleum industry or something like that, it's different enough that I can call the app that and it's not a big deal, but calling the company Bluetick would probably be an issue. So I'm going to go with something different. I haven't decided on what yet. I have to do that in the next couple of days, and then just make sure that you keep in mind all the stuff associated with places where the customer is actually going to see the company name. That's the big thing to keep in mind, because you don't want the company name to be so nonsensical or off the wall that if they read it or happen to glance at it, they don't look at it and say, wait a second, why am I getting this email? Especially if down the road, the company gets acquired or you sell it or something along those lines. And that kind of leads to the second piece of this, which is, should you put it underneath your current corporation or spin it off as a separate entity? And I decided to spin it off as a separate one just to keep all the books separate so that if later on I do decide to sell it, or if I do any sort of fundraising or, you know, anything like that, I want to have the books at least reasonably decent from a very early stage, as opposed to trying to separate it out much later. I'm past the point where I feel like I needed to do validation, because I probably wouldn't build a product and go incorporate and do all the things that are the quote unquote necessary things that you're supposed to do until after you've gotten to the point where you have revenue coming in the door and you know that the it's going to be something that it would be worth spinning it off into its own entity. Before that, I mean, you could easily end up in a situation where you get to 5 or 8 customers and then you have to shut it down because it's just not making enough money. And at that point, it costs you more to spin up the company and then shut it down than it did for the amount of money that you gathered from customers.
Yeah, I think that's a good perspective. I think in a perfect world, the corp would match the product name, but I don't think it really matters that much, honestly, because the only confusion I could imagine is it's the credit card statement, right? When you get a credit card statement and it's going to have the corp name typically and not the product name, that's the time where you may get confusion. And I've seen folks set up their corp.com, and all it is a page that says, confused about a charge from us? You probably use one of our apps. And then it has a few of them. So I really don't think it's that big of a deal from a branding perspective. I think one thing to think about is the liability. Well, really two things. One is liability, right? If you mix your consulting firm with a product, if one of them were to get sued or something, then they are both in the same bucket and there's no firewall between them. You'll have to use your judgment as to how big of a concern that is for you. For me, when I had a bunch of products, they were all under the Numa Group umbrella, and that name didn't match any of the products. And it was, never an issue for me. And I wasn't concerned about the liability because it was a bunch of small products that really weren't likely to get, have a lawsuit come in. But, again, it's risk tolerance there. And then the other aspect of it is if you ever want to sell it, if you just sell the technology, that's one thing. But if it ever gets acquired and people really want like the financials broken out, and if it's a like a startup acquisition, like a strategic, like we did with Drip, where it was they kind of bought all the assets in the company, it would have been a disaster. It would have been a disaster if Drip was still under the Numa Group. I spun it out maybe a year before the acquisition because it was just growing so much that I knew it needed to be its own company. And at that point, I started realizing, I mean, that was probably, we were probably between 30 and 50K MRR when I was like, I think there's going to be, I would hate for liability of Drip or of the Numa Group to spill into one another, and there needs to be a firewall. Now, the process of ripping that out was kind of a pain in the butt. It took several months, and I paid a lawyer several $1,000s to write up all the paperwork and to try to make sure everything was transferred. I had to set up separate payroll. I had to let go. The Numa Group had to let go of all of us, had to fire all the employees and then hire them, through Drip. It was pretty crazy. So I had 2 Gusto accounts, 2 different, corporate credit cards, 2 bank accounts, 2 Stripe accounts, too many things is what it was. But it was the right call. So you got to think about that. I think if you're just plugging away and starting something, you think you get to a few grand and hope to eventually sell it. Personally, I would probably just throw it under the same corporation, assuming that you've judged the liability and how much risk you're willing to take on. Because like Mike said, setting up the entire other entity and then never getting the product off the ground or never getting it past a couple grand in revenue, there's a lot of expense. You don't think there's that much expense, but there is. Setting it up front, if you're in a state with an annual fee, like California charges $800 a year just to have a corporation there, and then you need separate, like I said, separate software for the books, and then the CPA is going to have to file a separate tax return, and so that's an extra cost. So there's a lot to think about there, but I do think you're thinking about it right. And then his second question was, is it worth going through any steps for legal protection during your early development stages, specifically a trademark on your app name? What do you think about that?
I don't think so. I mean, if you're not making any money from it, it probably doesn't make a difference. Although, it's funny. I did recently see this lawsuit of a company called Twit versus Twitter.
Yes. Well, Twit is This Week in Tech, right? It's Leo Laporte's company.
Yeah, something along those lines. I don't remember. Like, I think that previously they had taken the standpoint, oh, this is just a couple of techies in a garage building this app on the side for some sort of social thing. It's not a big deal. And now it's suddenly a big deal. So it's...
Right. So TWiT is a video, well, it's podcasting network in essence, video and audio, and they're located in Northern California. And Leo Laporte has long time been a basically a tech newscaster for decades. And he has this network, and it's, I don't know, maybe 30 shows, and there's, you know, I don't know, a few dozen employees, and they have a studio up there north of San Francisco. And so he knew, I mean, as these guys were coming up, he has the trademark and the stuff, because, you know, for TWiT, and I don't know if he has Twitter or not, but he certainly, you know, has things. And I think that early on, he and Ev Williams had talked, and he has some type of written agreement, but it's not super, I don't think it's like ironclad. And then he definitely had, you know, verbal agreements he had talked about on the show before that, hey, as long as I stay out of like, you know, video and, you know, streaming audio and video that were in separate areas, but Twitter's now getting into that. But, you know, for Twitter, you know what they're going to do? They're going to settle, right? They'll pay them some money, I think. I mean, I don't know. They're big enough. They're a public company. It's not that they're doing great, but this type of thing is not catastrophic at their scale. Like, this lawsuits are things that you just throw some lawyers on it, and then eventually you settle and you pay someone $5 or $10 million and it goes away, you know?
But the point is that they got the app to that point without, you know, having had all that stuff. And yes, it's going to cost them, as you said, maybe it's $5 or $10 million, which sounds like a heck of a lot of money, but how much does Twitter pull in a year? So at the end of the day, it's not really that big a deal to them to have not had that trademark from day one, or have registered it, or have gone with a different one. You know, it's really just like you're trying to solve for a problem that you don't have and you may never have. I mean, because I don't think that most of us are going to be in a position where we have a business as large as Twitter and are defending it against a trademark that, because we never filed it or we never acquired it very early on in the startup.
Right. So I think I have mixed feelings about this one. Filing a trademark is a couple $100. It's not very expensive. It's not like a patent. So like software patents are what, 15 to 30 grand if you file one. Whereas a trademark is inexpensive and it's fairly easy to do. You can go to like LegalZoom or trying to think of what, there's a bunch of services that do this that are fairly, and it's pretty straightforward. Now, if you do it and you get rejected, then you have to go and justify and do all this stuff. But I don't know. I've only filed for, what have I filed for? I think one trademark of all the apps and all the stuff, you know, that I've done. And it was for Drip and it got rejected in the first round. And I was like, oh, good grief. So I don't know. I wouldn't say don't do it. I do think that it's, if you don't have an app yet, it's probably jumping the gun, you know, but it isn't that much time or money to do it. So I think you just kind of got to weigh it out. You know, I really don't know that there's a right or wrong one here, right or wrong answer.
I think it depends on how much money you are actually making from it. Because if you haven't made a dime from it, it's probably not worth filing the trademark. But when you get to the point where you've made, I don't know, maybe $1,000 or $2,000, at that point, you might consider it. Once you've made $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, maybe you really consider it. But I mean, you can always kind of push it off too, because you could file it based on prior usage. So there's that as well. And I think that with the Twitter issue, Twitter didn't do it first. It was the TWiT company. So they're the ones who, they didn't file for a trademark until, I think it was a year after Twitter was founded, but they had been previously using it. So that's why I think that's why they have that trademark.
Yeah, you're probably right. If you haven't made any money from it, you probably shouldn't file it, but there's a risk tolerance thing there, but I hear you. Cool. Well, I think that wraps us up for the day.
Yep, I think so too. So if you have a question for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupstherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. Subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups, and visit startupstherestofus.com for full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
All right. This is the after show. Like we say, what happens in the after show stays in the after show. We don't talk about it on Twitter or outside of this little couple minutes where Mike and I chat about things that are completely unrelated to startups or the rest of the podcast. So, Mike, have you seen The Punisher on Netflix?
I have not.
Do not bother.
Oh.
I bailed on it. I really like The Punisher as a character. I read the comic as a kid. It's a crossover with Daredevil. I don't know if I didn't get far enough to see if it actually crosses over, but The Punisher is a villain in season 2 of Daredevil and is really well portrayed. I like the Daredevil series on Netflix. I've already talked about it here. And so when they launched The Punisher, I was like, heck yeah, same actors playing it. I think this is going to be great. And man, I got through maybe an episode and a half, and it is so, it's just so like cliche. It's not very well written. It's not up to the standard of the other Marvel superhero stuff that they've done on Netflix.
Got it. Did you consider skipping ahead 4 or 5 episodes? Because I have seen cases
I might
where
need to. Yep. I really want it to work. You know, I really, because I do like the character so much. So I should probably skip an episode or two and just give it a shot.
Yeah, because I heard, because I had mentioned it briefly before about the Expanse series on the Sci-Fi Channel, where I'd watched the first couple of episodes, and the books are really good, and the TV show, it deviates from the books enough that I just couldn't keep watching it. And it was just, it felt like it was poorly written. And I was told by somebody, like, the first season is really slow, but it starts to get good at the end of the first season. And then it's, you know, the second season really picks up. And I have a hard time just like skipping that far forward, but I have read the book, so I could do that, I guess. But because they piece it together, it's a little discombobulated.
Sure. I can imagine that. The other thing I wanted to mention that is something I recommend is Handmaid's Tale on Hulu. Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it. I've not seen it.
Yeah, it won several Golden Globes, I believe. I kept hearing people talk about it kind of in the podcast spheres that I'm in, the tech podcast spheres. And I thought it was just based on the name, and I know it's a book from the early 80s, I thought that it was something, I heard it was really dark and brooding and really kind of hard to watch the first couple episodes. And I thought it was something from like the 1700s or the 1800s, like a handmaid from there. But it's actually a dystopian future. So it's like right up my alley because I really like dystopia and I like stories with, you know, I like sci-fi and stuff. So I recommend it. It's pretty brutal for the first episode or two. There's some shock value and disturbing, and then it gets much easier, you know. So it's they do it like with the HBO show, you know, where you watch Game of Thrones and like the first episode you're like, oh wow, can't watch any more of this, but then you get 2 or 3 in and it's like, okay, they start toning part of that down. So I think if you haven't watched it, especially, I mean, it's Hulu, so I think you can't you watch, I have a subscription, but I think you can watch a lot of Hulu stuff without, you know, without paying. It's worth watching an episode or two just to get the flavor of it. But it's really well written, it's really well acted. I like things that are based on books because they tend to be well thought out, and I think it's something I'd recommend if you can get over kind of the darkness of it.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out. It does look interesting. There was another show that they converted from books. It was the Shannara series. I forget what they had, which channel it was on. It was either Netflix or Hulu or something like that. And it was okay. They did a decent job with some of the special effects, but the story itself was really, it dragged a lot. Although having read the first book in that series, that dragged a heck of a lot more than the show. So.
Mm-hmm. And lastly, I am just embarking on, I'm going to watch Electric Dreams on Amazon Prime. Have you heard of it?
No, what's that?
It is, so you know who Philip K. Dick is?
No.
He's a sci-fi writer. So he's the guy, he wrote the books that these movies are based on. Minority Report, Blade Runner, Total Recall. Like he was an extremely prolific sci-fi writer who has impacted, he came up with concepts that are all over the place in sci-fi. So really, I haven't read much of his stuff, but every time a show gets made, The Man in the High Castle, he wrote the book that's based on too. So anyways, he wrote a bunch of short stories, and Electric Dreams is Amazon doing an anthology series of those short stories. So, and if, you know, for those who haven't heard the term anthology series, it's like, think of like the Twilight Zone or of Dark Mirror, where each episode, it's not the same characters and it's not the same story, but there's kind of a theme of them. And so I've heard that this is pretty good. And I think they got some big name actors in different episodes. So I have not seen any of it, but my expectations are high. So I'll report back once I'm through a few episodes. And I think they have maybe 10 to 12 episodes. I always dig anthology series. I'm a big fan of the Twilight Zone and of the episodes that I've seen of Black Mirror.
Yeah, definitely let me know. I don't watch a whole lot of TV just because my expectations have been completely shot over the years. So I don't even bother to watch new shows when they come out just because I'll wait until somebody tells me that it's good and gives me a recommendation before I waste my own time on it.
Totally. I can see that. Yeah, I don't watch... I realize when I say this, like, hey, I'm watching all this TV. I don't actually watch that much, but it's one of the things Sherry and I do when we just want to unwind in the evening after the kids are in bed. We will watch like one or two episodes of something it's not every night either. You know, it's a couple nights a week. And then anytime I'm on a plane, that's all I do is watch stuff. I don't work well on planes. I actually get sick. I get motion sick. So for me, like just sitting and watching or reading is about what I can muster. So, but I'll pack up. We fly quite a bit, right? We travel frequently, especially during the winter. So like, as an example, now I have 8 or 9 episodes of Electric Dreams downloaded on my phone. Blade Runner 2049, which I haven't seen. I'm pretty stoked about. I was a huge fan of the first Blade Runner. I have some other things. I think I have The Prophet and Shark Tank and a couple of reality shows that I can, those are my guilty pleasures.
Yes. I think Sherry had mentioned those at MicroConf one year.
Yeah. And I watch Comic Book Men too. Yes. As a comic book fan, I don't like reality TV. I just feel like it's so staged and everything, but these are things that kind of hit on, parts that I'm interested in.
Cool. Well, like I said, I just avoid TV in general.
That's not a bad thing. No, I agree. It's not, I don't think that's a detriment. It's like, if you take that time and decompress another way, or you just work instead of watching it, I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yep.
I mean, there were years when I didn't watch TV or movies, when I was growing Drip, when I was revamping there's a time to do it. And then there's obviously times to maybe relax and recharge, which isn't the mode I'm in right now.
Yeah. The mode I'm in is just, you know, working on stuff for Blue Tick. So,
yep. Totally.
Yep.
Been there, man. All right.
Well, take it easy and talk to you next week.
All right. Bye.